Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember the worst of the financial crisis? Banks not lending to each other? Credit drying up? Yeah, that's what the world's central banks were trying to avoid today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 30th of November. Good to have you here. The first thing you need to do, though, is forget everything you've heard since this morning about the stock market and central banks. Because, yes, the world's major central banks did announce a joint move to ease the worsening credit squeeze in Europe. And, yes, traders practically the world over took that news and ran with it. But really, when the Fed and the European Central Bank basically start giving away dollars, something's going on. So step number one today is understanding exactly what the banks did. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner gets us going.
As Europe's debt crisis intensifies, lending is drying up. Banks there have had more trouble getting financing, including in dollars. Today's emergency move by the Fed and other central banks makes securing those greenbacks easier. But investment strategist Hugh Johnson says the larger aim was boosting confidence in Europe's financial system.
It's a very bold move on the part of these central banks, and it shows that everybody recognizes that Europe has a problem.
A problem that includes European banks increasingly reluctant to lend to each other. That's because they're saddled with the risky debt of countries like Italy, Greece, and Spain. Susan Fulton, president at FBB Capital Partners, says Europe's facing the same crisis the U.S. did in 2008, a credit crunch. She suspects a number of big European banks were in need of life support.
What this really did was give the European Union a blood transfusion for a patient that's critically ill and would probably have died if this hadn't happened.
That transfusion may resuscitate lending, but it doesn't cure Europe's debt crisis disease. Simon Johnson is former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund.
If you just treat the symptoms, just try to bring down the fever, without dealing with the underlying cause of that fever, that could turn out to be not particularly helpful.
European leaders will meet next week to try once again to tackle the continent's debt problems. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Thus, step number two in the news of the day is understanding why the central banks did what they did, the much-vaunted liquidity injection. For that, we've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on the line. Hey, Heidi.
Hey.
All right. So first of all, liquidity injection. In layman's terms, please, what does that mean?
Well, liquidity is really easy to understand. It just means making sure that there's a buyer for every seller. So in this case, European banks need to buy dollars and no one's selling to them because they're in a dangerous place. So the Fed is saying, we'll sell those dollars to you and we'll make it cheap. Think about it as like putting oil in your car, right? So your car needs oil to run to keep those gears moving. And it's dollars that make that economy work. And those dollars are drying up in Europe. And so the Fed is saying, we'll help you inject some oil back in this so that you can keep your economy running. And by turns, that means that the U.S. economy will keep running.
Right. But the Europeans have their own oil, right? They have euros. Why do they need our oil, if I can torture the metaphor?
Yeah, well, think about what a euro means, right? It is this currency backed by 17 countries that can't agree on anything that just 3 days ago we're talking about breaking up, right? I mean, we've got our problems, but that's not our problem. So we're looking preferable. But also the dollar is the way that the financial system does business, right? All these banks are global. They lend to American companies. They take money from American investors. And just the same way that the language of business is English, right? The currency of business is the dollar.
Help me understand then why this is the solution, because, you know, I understand the idea of cash sloshing around in the system and that being a good thing. But aren't a lot of these countries and a lot of the people whose debt is in question here broke? Are we treating the right symptom?
No, you're absolutely right. This is more of a painkiller because the causes here are the Eurozone and its incredible troubles. And you can't fix that. You need the politicians to fix it. So what this does is just make sure that the banks at least have some running room and a little bit of safety if anything really bad happens. And we've seen the Fed and the European Central Bank do this every single time we have a crisis. They usually jump in when they see a specific threat to banks and they say, we're going to lend to you because we see no one else will.
Well, can we assume then, based on what they did today, that the banks saw something, the central banks saw something that scared them and thus were forced to act?
It would be speculation, but it sounds like that might be the case only because this week has been such a fever pitch of rumors, right? We started out on Monday with rumors about the breakup of the Eurozone, which is kind of a financial Armageddon. So probably things were getting so dire and the rumors were getting so sharp that the central banks thought we have to do something.
And so they did. Heidi Moore in our New York Bureau. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
The aforementioned Wall Street had just a spiffy time today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among all the countries in the European Union, the Dutch economy is in the top 10, number 6 to be exact. It's been described as a mini Germany, prosperous and stable, and like much larger Germany and France, eager to see the euro come out of this crisis intact. That's where Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and I started our conversation, with me asking him whether saving the euro is worth all the trouble.
Yes, it is vital. Our policy from the Dutch government is to have the bloc of 17 countries intact and at the same time have very good relationships with the 10 European Union member states which are not part of the Eurogroup, like the UK and Sweden, because these are the countries which are very much oriented towards more jobs, growth and prosperity. So we need also their input in the whole project.
Why is this so hard then? I mean, if everybody agrees that the goal is to save the euro and take care of this debt crisis, why can't we get from point A to point B?
Two reasons. One is that in the southern part of Europe, in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, the public debt has run to a too high level and they have done not enough to get it under control. So that's one reason. The second is that the markets want to see from the currency area, from all 17, that we are stand ready to help a country like Greece or Italy if it needs support. There is still debate. Should you do this by the central bank, increasing the money supply, or should it be done by the European fund itself? We believe it should be the latter, the European fund, because otherwise you run the risk of inflation, monetary financing, increasing the amount of money in itself, and it would take away the pressure from Greece and Italy to reform.
Why is that pressure still not having any effect, though? I mean, there's pressure from the entire global economy.
Well, the pressure is having effect. It is not having its effect where we want it to, which is in the interest rate. So there you're right. But it is having a huge effect in the sense that now in Italy there's a new government. We've had the French president on television for 45 minutes telling his people that the French should behave more like the Germans. Well, could you imagine a couple of years ago a French president having this message on his television? Impossible. Take Spain, where we now have the socialist government leaving, a new conservative government coming in with a pledge of getting the budget deficit under control. So I would say so far the result has been extremely good. The only problem is, and that's because there's not enough firepower now in the European pot of money to help these countries, that the markets are not sure that the others are willing to help if something goes wrong.
Yeah, you know, you said things are going, the results have been extremely good, and I have to quibble with you there because I don't think anybody would say that what has been happening in Europe has been extremely good. The markets are upset, countries are on the brink, and yet there doesn't seem to be a solution.
Well, let's also take another look. Portugal and Ireland, a couple of years ago, they seemed at the brink of disaster. In the meantime, they came around. They are still in programs. They are still under. They still get help from the European Facility Stability Mechanism. But they are coping. They are not any longer at the brink of disaster. So Ireland and Portugal are cases in point that we can deal with this crisis.
Mr. Prime Minister, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai Rizdal, thank you so much for your time.
It looks like the payroll tax cut is maybe, probably, possibly going to be extended past the end of the year, assuming Democrats and Republicans can find a way to pay for it. We all know what happens when you assume, though, so get ready for the umpteenth round of the budget fight. Commentator Robert Reich has a suggestion as we head into it.
The basic bargain at the heart of the American economy used to be that employers paid their workers enough to buy what employers were selling. That bargain created a virtuous cycle of higher living standards, more jobs, and better wages. Back in 1914, Henry Ford decided to pay his workers three times the average factory wage because they'd used the money to buy Model Ts. His profits doubled in 2 years. But now that bargain has come apart. New data from the Commerce Department shows employee pay down to the smallest share of the economy since the government began collecting the data in 1929, and corporate profits the largest share of the economy since then. Yet, incredibly, some politicians think the best way to restart the nation's job engine is to make corporations even more profitable. That means reducing corporate taxes and cutting back on regulations. These same politicians want average workers to have even less money. They're against extending the payroll tax cut or unemployment benefits, and they want to make it harder for workers to form unions. These politicians have it upside down. The reason companies aren't creating more jobs is because consumers don't have money, and their spending accounts for 70% of the economy. You see, without the basic bargain, we're in a vicious cycle. The only way out is to put more money into the pockets of average Americans. At the very least, extend the payroll tax cut and unemployment benefits. Beyond this, we need a new WPA to get the long-term unemployed back to work, and a civilian conservation corps to create jobs for young people, more teachers for overcrowded classrooms, more construction workers rebuilding highways and bridges. Pay for all this by hiking taxes on millionaires. Get it? There's really only one way to revive the American economy. That's by restoring the basic bargain.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. We hope your comments are in our future. Send us your thoughts, if you would, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up.
Reinvent yourself. That's what women do. We reinvent ourselves when things aren't working. I don't want to hear na-na-na-na-na.
Finding a job is like finding a mate. Who knew? But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street hopped higher on a host of hopeful headlines today, pushed the blue chips back into the green for the year. The Dow Industrials soared 490 points, 4.25%. Topped out for the day at 12,045, the big board's biggest single-day gain since March of 2009. The NASDAQ up 104 points, just above 4%, finished at 2620. The S&P 500 advanced 51 points, 4.33%, closed at 1246. Seven winners for every loser on the New York Stock Exchange today, by the by. Financials took a big turn for the better, surprise, surprise. Citigroup shares deposited almost 9%. Stock in JPMorgan Chase jumped up nearly 8.5% today. The improved European outlook gave Caterpillar a leg or two or a million up. Shares of the heavy equipment maker climbed more than 8% today. Bond prices slipped. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.07%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for October. President Obama speaks at an event marking World AIDS Day at George Washington University. And later in the day, the president lights the national Christmas tree. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. American presidents as far back as like Richard Nixon, I think, have talked about weaning this country off foreign oil, or at the very least, cutting back on how much we import from less than friendly places. Well, looky here. This year, the U.S. of A. is on track to become a net petroleum exporter for the first time since the days of Harry Truman, with one big asterisk. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Here it is. We're net exporters of what you call petroleum products, but we still import millions of barrels of crude oil every day. So what are petroleum products? Consultant David Goldwyn, former top official at the State Department, says U.S. drilling
has produced a lot of byproducts which we don't need. And some of those are unfinished oils and other products, so we're able to sell those to other countries and reduce our balance of payments.
These are hydrocarbons like ethane to make chemicals, or the raw material for diesel. Now, this boom is connected to an American crude oil boom. New technology gets crude, as well as natural gas, out of tight shale rock. Energy economist Philip Verleger says that means
we won't be importing Nigerian crude, we won't be importing West African crude, and we probably won't be importing crude from Brazil. I mean, we will be almost self-sufficient.
Will be. Someday. Right now, Americans produce about half of what we burn. The rest still gets shipped in. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And now our Marketplace business word of the day, McSmarter. I'll do it again. Here you go. McSmarter. Last year, San Francisco passed a law meant to give the Happy Meal a body blow. It bans fast food restaurants from including toys in kids' meals that don't meet certain nutritional guidelines. Free toys in those kids' meals. And that is where McSmarter comes in. The No Free Toys law takes effect tomorrow, which is the same day that McDonald's in San Francisco are going to start charging a dime to include a toy with those mini bags of fries and chicken nuggets. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
You could say McDonald's found a loophole big enough to drive a burger mobile through. Sarah Senator is a restaurant analyst with Sanford Bernstein in New York, as you'll hear.
McDonald's is masterful at evolving with the, you know, not only with the customer demand, but also the operating environment.
Rajiv Bhatia is with the San Francisco Health Department. He's looking at McDonald's shrewd sidestepping of the law as a teachable moment.
We need to learn from how industry reacts to it to revisit it and get it to achieve its purpose.
Bhatia didn't put a price tag on passing and implementing the law. Darren Tristano is with the food industry consultant Technomic.
You know, it could have been tens of thousands in research just to try and understand, you know, the impact.
As for the impact on McDonald's, there won't be one. It's donating the toy money to the Ronald McDonald House. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve released its beige book today, the central bank's regular look at the American economy, region by region. It's mostly good news to report. Consumer spending and tourism were up, as was manufacturing, which is a change from the recent past, because American factories have lost millions of jobs. Cheaper labor overseas is the main culprit. So the factories we do have here have had to adapt to stay competitive. Today, in the first of two stories, how American manufacturers are reinventing themselves. From the public media project Changing Gears, Dan Bobkoff reports.
Don't tell Matt Lavin manufacturing is dead. Togas Products in suburban Cleveland may be in the rust belt, but there's no rust here. Instead, gleaming robots do much of the hard labor, while young staff work on computers and iPads.
I wanted to create a Google of manufacturing environment.
Togas has been around since 1950. And for most of its history, it was like any traditional U.S. manufacturer. It made money through mass production, in this case making plastic parts for the automakers and the beverage industry, among others. The economics were simple. The more you make of something, the cheaper you can sell it. But then along came China and other developing countries that could do the same work for a lot less. When Lavin took over the company from his late mother in 2008, he realized he needed to take Togas in a different direction. Now it's all about special orders, not economies of scale.
It's a Burger King economy. It's have it your way right away. Mass customization, not mass production. India, China are built for mass production.
Togas now makes low volumes of highly engineered products, like gears with built-in lubrication so they don't need to be oiled. His customers want help with designs and materials and creating prototypes, services that are not always feasible in China.
I don't consider us a manufacturing company anymore. We're a technology and services company.
But this new kind of factory requires a different kind of worker. Under the mass production model, people with limited skills could be trained to perform the same manual task over and over. With almost all production automated, Togus increasingly needs people with high-level training or college degrees.
And we hired our first engineer, who's actually standing right behind you, right out of school.
When Lavin charted the company's new direction in 2009, he laid off half of his more traditional factory workers. The company's staff now includes 15 engineers. But what happens to the mostly unskilled workers pushed aside by advanced manufacturing?
Is everybody booted up and logged on?
A few miles from Togus, Darlene Schreffler sits in a computer class at Lorain County Community College. Until the downturn, she'd spent 18 years as a welder working in factories. She's been out of work for 3 years.
I've been living with friends and doing what I can. It's hard.
Schreffler says no one has wanted to hire her because her skills weren't advanced enough. She can weld, but she can't set up and maintain the kind of computerized equipment needed on today's shop floor.
They want somebody that knows everything instead of somebody that knows one thing.
Besides that computer class, Schreffler is taking pre-algebra and learning to program high-tech machinery. As more manufacturers begin to look like Togus, Schreffler hopes she and her classmates will be ready. But America has lost 8 million manufacturing jobs in the past 3 decades. Even if companies like Togus keep the sector alive, it's not going to bring many of those jobs back. Ron Bloom is President Obama's former assistant for manufacturing policy.
The aggregate number of jobs per se in manufacturing is not going to be huge. But that's the price of a productive sector. That's not a bad thing.
How productive? Even with a smaller staff, Togus says its revenues have more than doubled. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow from Changing Gears, the night shift gets a makeover. Whatever the news is when the November unemployment report comes out Friday morning, there will likely be no change in one economic indicator. Finding work still isn't easy. So many people, so few jobs. It can be, in some ways, not unlike looking for love. So we asked Patty Stanger and Destin Paff to come in and give us some pointers. You might have heard of them. They are the millionaire matchmakers of the reality show on Bravo of the same name that helps rich people find love. We decided to extend that metaphor a bit. Hey, guys, welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, how are you?
So the reason we have you guys in here is to talk about this connection we came up with between finding love and finding a job. There are some similarities, Destin, yes?
Oh, there's absolutely similarities. I mean, it starts right off with the interview. I mean, when you go on a first date, you can never make a first impression twice. When you go in an interview, don't go in there casual and cocky. Go in there wanting to show your best you.
And yet there are some problems. Let's play a piece of tape from the show.
One of the problems of being in the dating situation and being rusty is that they vomit too much information. It's TMI. And that's a really difficult thing.
Vomit too much information.
Yes.
I mean, there are things you don't need to share in a job interview, just
no.
Like you don't need to share them on a date.
No. You know, now they can ask for your credit background.
Right.
Okay. So I wouldn't recommend telling people, you know, well, I've been out of debt, I've been out of work, but I'm a real hard worker. Yeah, nobody's going to want to hire you.
All right. But what are you supposed to do, though? I mean, you're out there, you're desperate for a job. What are you supposed to do?
If you're a single man or you're a single woman, you go out there and you date. You date and you date and you date until you find the person that's the one. The last person that you date is the last person you're going to be with. You don't need to look anymore. The same thing goes for jobs.
How do you not get stale, though, right? If you date and you date and you date and you date, it gets stale. I mean, you can only go and have dinner and a movie.
Well, we call that dating detox. After a while, if you're not hitting, you take a break for 3 months. And in this case, you take a break to redefine who you want to be. So let's say, for instance, I'm looking for a computer job and it's not working.
Right.
Okay. Maybe I need to expand my horizons, you know, and do something related to computers.
Yeah.
There's lots of things that you can do.
Right.
But here's the thing. You can get the job. Doesn't mean you're going to keep the job. You can get the guy, doesn't mean you're going to keep the guy. Staying there, building your net worth in who you are, because that's really what a job's about. That's just the same thing as dating.
What happens when you find the perfect job, you're really excited about it, you've had a great interview, same as on a date, find a great woman, find a great man, and they don't like you as much? How do you handle that rejection?
You have to learn to know that God's rejection, okay, is really protection.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at it like that, and your number will come up. But it's a lot of perseverance. You can't take it personally.
As a society, as America in general, we've gotten really wimpy, And it's just make a bridge and get over it. I mean, if you didn't get the job, you really wanted that job.
I'm sorry,
that
wait, men have?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, God, hello? Yeah.
Okay, women are multitaskers. They take jobs for less money when they should be taking more, okay? Reinvent yourself. That's what women do. We reinvent ourselves when things aren't working. I don't want to hear na-na-na-na-na.
There comes a time in every relationship or job application process where the other person is more into you. Right? Mm-hmm. And the employer's more into you, and you're like, yeah, no, I really don't want this. How do you gracefully handle that?
What I would do in a situation like that is, because you never know where you're going to need a favor, I keep the door open. And I'd say, listen, I'm really not feeling this job's right for me at this time, but I have a friend. But I would also say, let's keep it going here, because maybe there's a better job in their company that will come up in 6 months.
Right.
And it's the same thing with love. I put a lot of people on ice, you know, and the truth of the matter is
she
works.
She says heartlessly.
It works. Now, have I been wrong? Of course I've been wrong. And sometimes the job you think is the pain in the you-know-what can turn out to be the greatest job in your life.
Patty Stanger and Destin Paff from The Millionaire Matchmaker. It's on Bravo. On our website, they gave us 5 extra tips that apply to both job hunters and date seekers. Check them out, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, there is hope yet for bipartisanship in the Senate of the United States. For the first time ever, as far as anybody can tell, senators are going to do a Secret Santa thing this Christmas. $10 is the price limit. 58 senators have signed up, 37 Democrats, 21 from the GOP. Nobody, though, in the leadership so far. But it's not like they're going to solve the budget deficit, but a nice gesture, don't you think? I do. And that's it. That's all we got. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 490 points, 4.25%. The NASDAQ gained 104. That's just above 4%. The S&P 500 bounced 51 points higher, 4.33%. All, obviously, on that central bank news. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, back here, you know, if she wanted to, German Chancellor Angela Merkel could solve the Eurozone crisis like that.
What she will not do, it seems to me, is to give the European Central Bank carte blanche to print money.
I'm Kyle Risdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.